This is me taking a bow in respect of Shogun, because it's great. Hello, interwebs, and welcome to Close Up. I'm your co-host, Joe.
And I'm Ryan.
We're talking about Shogun today. Full spoilers ahead. But if you want the basics, it's great. On to our medium shot.
Fantastic show.
How did you get into Shogun?
People at work told me to watch it. I needed a new show to watch, so I started watching Shogun. That's basically it. I didn't know anything about Shogun, didn't know it was a book, didn't know it was somewhat based on a real life story. Didn't know anything about it. I just heard it was good.
Yeah. I was just scrolling through Disney Plus and found the thumbnail with it, with I think it was Hiroyuki Sanada in samurai armor riding towards the screen, and I'm like, this is a really cool thumbnail. I want to see what this is about. So then I started reading the description. I'm like, oh, this sounds cool too. Okay. You mean I'm discovering something organically? This is weird. Okay. But then as I read the description, it started sounding familiar. And I realized that I'd actually heard some of this story before from Justin, because months and months ago, he actually read the book, not knowing a show was coming out. But he read that book and actually told me some stuff about it at the time. So when I read the description, oh, is it based on that book? Oh, cool, it is. And yeah, so then I watched it, and my pacing watching this show was pretty weird. I had to catch up. It was already like five episodes in when I finally sat down and get going on it. And then sometimes I wouldn't watch one for a couple weeks because I got busy, and then I was just kind of back and forth all the time on it. Didn't get a consistent viewing experience, but that's okay. So let's get into our close-up and talk about Shogun now. And where do you want to start?
I don't know, because it's all pretty good.
There's a lot.
Yeah,
there's,
I was kind of the same way. I was playing catch up as well. I think like episode 6 had come out when I started watching, and then I took like breaks and then binged it a couple episodes here and there, and just finished it today as a time of recording, because today was the final episode was released. I kind of loved how different it is from like regular TV limited series type things. Just kind of how like I kind of jumping the shark here a little bit, but it's interesting to see like a show that like is building up for like a big climactic battle, but kind of diverts your expectations in the way and doesn't do that, but does it in a satisfying way at the same time. That's like true to the story a little bit.
You know why I thought that was extra brilliant was because episode 9 was called Crimson Sky, the name of the big operation. And then with 20 minutes, like Yabushigi was just about to commit seppuku in the end. And I'm like, this is 20 minutes from the end. Are they doing a big battle? And then Toranaga tells him, oh yeah, Crimson Sky already happened. I'm like, of course it did. Yep.
Yeah.
That makes sense. They're not doing a thing, are they? This is it.
Mariko is Crimson Sky. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is so awesome to be like, the big climax already happened and you didn't notice. Stupid.
Yeah. Idiot. I love the... again, we're jumping the shark, but I do love the ending, how it kind of shows you, like, the, you know, the armies coming together and, like, what will happen in the future of just, like, oh, she's on my side now because, you know, her friend was killed by your men. And I just love how, like, it's just brilliant. Hironoki Sanada is a legend, and... He
was the only cast member
in the show.
He's the only cast member I knew going in.
You don't recognize Rodriguez, who was in Bates Motel?
Yeah, so actually, I'm looking at the cast list right now, and now that I see him without the makeup, I recognize him.
Yeah, without the beard, you're like, hey, it's the guy. Yeah.
I knew I liked him. Too bad he doesn't show up again after he leaves.
I know. I really liked him. He like he's barely in this show. I thought he was going to be like a number two to Blackthorn? John yeah. Blackthorn? Yeah.
The repartee was one Andrew of the best parts of those early episodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love their banter between each other.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just I love the world building of the show. How it really does just take you back to like the 1600s, Japan with the samurai theme. It's really funny because I'm in the middle of a Ghost of Tsushima playthrough, and it just sort of like the show coming out at the same time, and how both are just kind of set at around. No, the Ghost of Tsushima is set way longer than the 1600s. I'm pretty sure, but it's still kind of the old traditional Japanese samurai way. Yeah, it's just, it's phenomenal world building at the same time. The production design and costumes are phenomenal. And, like, it feels like the actual thing. It doesn't feel tacky. It feels very, I heard the showrunner said it took them, like, 5 years to make this.
Wow.
So.
I was watching some behind.
And
they wanted to do, like, the whole book.
That's what I know, is they want to do the whole book in one season. That's why it's limited series. And, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
there's
a lot
of talk online right now that hopes for season two, but the showrunners don't want to do a season two. So I think it's fine where it is. But sorry, go ahead.
They already adapted the book, as far as I realize, anyway. I know that author has different novels set in Japanese time periods. He's kind of got which some people say is a loose world with a few Easter eggs connected, but not really. They're just different periods in Japanese history. So if you want to adapt more James Clavell novels, go ahead. But this story's done. Doesn't need a season two. Because that's what a miniseries is. You adapted it. You told your story in 10 episodes, and that's fine. It doesn't need to be more. It wasn't designed to be more. This is it. You told the story you needed to tell. And bow and walk off stage. Take the accolades and run.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's funny. I liked all the characters in this. I don't think there was one character in this show that I didn't like watching, because I think everybody's goals were set up pretty well. I mean, there's characters that that the story makes you hate, but like you kind of love to hate them at the same time. Yeah, yeah.
He was the he was the best though.
Just that guy. I love that actor. He's great.
What's his name? Tadanobu Asano.
Mm-hmm, yeah, he's in some of the Thor movies. He's one of the.
Oh really?
Yeah, he's one of the like Thor's buddies.
Warriors 3.
Yeah, the Warriors 3. He's one of those guys.
Hmm.
Yeah.
See, I can tell you how good the hair and makeup and costume departments did, because I'm looking at the cast list, like I said, and seeing them.
They all have hair.
But seeing them just as themselves, they all look distinctly different to me.
Yeah.
It's like, crazy. Wow, they really made you look so different on the show.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty nuts. It's pretty nuts.
Yeah.
It's really funny how, like, because it is sort of a, it's funny because it's a Western show, but it's made for more of, like, Eastern audience at the same time, because there's so much. I love the fact that it's mostly in Japanese. I thought that was a really good choice.
Yes.
Really sets the world building as well. And they kind of pull you in with Blackthorn, as they're like, oh, is this guy going to be the main character? Nope. He's just there as kind of like a catalyst for learning the Japanese culture. But, I thought he was great too. He has got a great like just voice, just like British voice. Cosmo Jarvis,
for sure.
I could see him doing like,
yeah.
I could see him doing some sort of like voice acting later on.
Yeah, his voice is one of the first things that made me be like, "Ooh, I like this guy."
Mm-hmm.
He's commanding. Yeah. He's got presence.
Yeah. He's in Peaky Blinders. I don't know where he is in Peaky Blinders. I gotta look that up. Anyway.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about this show, like you said, is the fact that it's mostly in Japanese, which I noticed that's been a trend lately of, personally, and correct me if you think this was different, but personally, when Parasite won the Oscar for Best Picture, that kind of blew open the doors for international films to get made in their own language.
Oh, absolutely. You know,
even me being a film critic and just a lover of film in general, even at film school, I was pretty stubborn about international films. Not that I thought they were lesser films. I just didn't want to watch with subtitles, which was me being ignorant and just really focused on my little slice of the world, for sure. But and just think away about the way the Hollywood industry is generally gone. It's like, oh, well, something can be considered fantastic on the other side of the world, but it's not considered, quote unquote, legitimate till it gets an English adaptation.
Yeah.
Which is so weird. Now we're just getting more accepting of things being done well the first time and just watching it over here. And
yeah,
I mean, this was made by Westerners with a big Japanese crew and a focus on authenticity for culture reasons, but it was chosen to be like made in Japanese. English characters speak English and Japanese characters speak Japanese. Portuguese was kind of shafted, but that's neither here nor there. They wanted to simplify.
Well, it's kind of funny. There's like, I was a little confused because Marco or another character speaks English to Blackthorn at one point, and then he goes, "You speak Portuguese." So I kind of assumed them speaking English in the show Portuguese was their substitute was Portuguese every time.
Every time,
yeah, that's what I assumed it was.
Which is
even like when he's talking to his crew at the beginning, he's like, "Because I also speak Portuguese." So that's what I assumed. That was the only switch up. But yeah, I agree with your point. Like, I think with Parasite, if Parasite didn't happen and it didn't win all the accolades, we wouldn't have gotten, you know, Squid Game, this show, Society of a Snow, All Quiet on the Western Front adaptation, like in all German. But yeah, I completely agree with that point, and I'm glad it happened because to see, like it done authentically well, just adds a sort of authenticity to it that is brilliant.
Because I remember growing up, it was always just par for the course for when English speaker goes to foreign country, everybody just talks English, even though you know they're talking in their native language in the story.
Yeah.
But they're just talking English so we can understand. And I noticed more and more it's just, okay, well, wherever we go in the world, characters just speak what they're actually speaking and you got to catch up. Which, I mean, for the point, for the purposes of this story, that's kind of the whole point. John Blackthorne's the fish out of water who doesn't know the Japanese language at all and needs translating the entire time. So he's kind of the audience stand-in for Westerners stepping into this world they don't understand and having to figure it out through Mariko's interpretation of it. Which I think it would be even more, can you imagine a gutsier version of Shogun without any subtitles? If it was just like, like John who doesn't understand anything except what Mariko is telling him.
I mean, that's what Disney Plus tried to do to me after that's the first mode. Episode. It was like it went hard. I had to manually put on subtitles in order to watch the show because I'm sorry, I don't speak Japanese. It's a beautiful language, but I just don't speak it. But for some reason, Disney Plus decided to glitch out on TV anyway.
Did for me too.
That would be insane if they did that. I know there's some movies that I don't know if they do that or maybe just like. I distinctly have a memory of watching The Godfather on like cable TV back in the day, and for like a certain scene there wasn't subtitles, but then there was subtitles later on in that scene. So I can't remember if that's part of the movie or if it was just like a weird glitch. I don't know.
Interesting. I don't know. Usually if there's subtitles encoded in a movie, like usually that is intentional.
Yeah. It's so weird because like with streaming now, they print, when movies come out now, they like sort of release to, I think I brought this up before. They'll do like their version of subtitles, but then if when they go to streaming, they give them like a clean version with no subtitles coded into the movie so that it's easier for streaming services to like do subtitles in different languages that aren't just English.
Yeah.
So it's just like automated. So yeah, Netflix did that and now everybody does that. And it's kind of annoying, especially if you have to manually put them on. But anyway. You know, another thing to add to our list of inanimate objects are just work, but back to the show. I love, it's just, I loved how the main character, Torinaga is just, he's just a brilliant mastermind. He's also like, he's a great, like, warlord and he's great, has good tactical strategy, but his real power comes from him outsmarting everybody. And I loved how that just all, culminated in the finale, how he has to go up against not one but all like four high regents of the council, even though they're all being led by Ishido.
Yeah,
and it's a very different way of telling like a story like this, and I appreciate it and really enjoyed the intellectual storytelling yes. that this show did. Because it's so different than what we're used to. Because we're probably would have expected a big climactic battle. Because they were setting it up for the entire season, you could argue. Especially with the effects of, like, the dismemberments and the, that cannon scene. When, like, that one soldier was, like, half blown up but still talking. The makeup was insane. It looks so real. Yeah.
Fantastic prosthetics there.
Yeah, so I thought they were setting up for this big, gory battle.
Yeah. See, but that was the hint, right? They named Crimson Sky Episode 9.
Right.
So that should have been your hint. You're like, oh, well, Crimson Sky didn't happen in Episode 9. All we got was Mariko fighting off a bunch of guys on her way out of the castle and totally owning everybody all episode in a mental chess game where they're like, well, We can't let you leave without looking weak, but we can't make you stay without admitting we're holding everybody hostage in the open. And either way, we're going to get a revolt. So there's no winning here. So we're just going to say you can leave and then try to kill you in the middle of the night. But even by your death and assassinating you in the middle of the night, you still win because we killed you. And like, she wins even more, actually, because I saw, somebody on Reddit had a great point that I had to write down in my notes because it explained it so well. Despite the death, this was a huge W for Mariko. Fulfill her lord's command, avoid suicide death, indulge in her personal desires, and die as a martyr per her beliefs. What a character, bravo. Great point
there. Yeah, for sure. And it's like, it's a character who's always wanted to die as well. And,
which is also in a way,
like
in the last episode, though, I thought it was because the whole show, you think she wants to die, but then she's talking to Buntaro after, and he's like, okay, if you want to die so bad, we can go to Osaka and we'll die in a blaze of glory together. And she's like, I'd rather live forever than die with you. Like, you don't get it. I just want to be away from you.
That's
like,
such dying a sad is just scene.
A way to do that.
Yeah. It's a sad scene because, like, that character is a dick and he's an asshole because he's a wife abuser, first of all.
But he's also just like a pretty honorable guy in general. He's like, he doesn't hold the grudges. And, yeah. He's a very layered character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought he was gone. I thought he was dead in episode 3. I was like, oh, they're setting up a Blackthorn and Mariko romance, and he shows up after they've hooked up, and you're like, oh, fuck, it's going to get spicy.
It did.
Yeah.
Their romance was the best part of the show. It was it was a very slow burn.
I love their chemistry.
Built on mutual respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He thinks she's a savage. She thinks he's a barbarian.
Yeah. Both very attractive people.
Well, yeah.
Both good looking people. But yeah, I love the how Mariko is like put in this such like high respected role. Kind of like a second to Torunaga.
Yeah.
And how much power she has. And yeah, I love their like their banter between each other, Blackthorn and Mariko. It's just it's well done. Well done relationship and chemistry building. Even when like the first time they hook up the next day, she's keeping it a secret because it's, you know, she's really not supposed to do that. But
yeah.
And then like, or maybe she would have gone with it further, but then her husband survives and then, you know, later on things happen. So it's just a great just kind of a roller coaster of a relationship on screen. Really enjoyed it.
She's teaching him all her philosophies and he's trying to impart his beliefs on her too to less success.
Yeah,
I thought it was an interesting
trying to
subversion.
Teach her about like meaning of life and you know,
it's like
how to
don't
treat
throw your life
women
away
or differently in his country.
Yeah. I love that one scene where they're talking about, oh, well, what if I could take you back to London with me? What would basically describing what would a date look like if you could take me out to London. And he was just describing for her, like, oh, I'd take you out here or there and walk along the banks of the Thames. And that was a nice scene.
Smells
just
like
for
shit.
Her to. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a really nice scene. Yeah.
Just for her to imagine, there's another world out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On the brink of war, still have those nice touching moments.
Yeah. Although, personally, I love John's relationship with Fuji. That was the secret in this show that, like, it was like him and Mariko were the thing that the show's setting up, but him and Fuji were just really fun together. Especially in the beginning, she's like, I don't want to be his consort. He's going to abuse me. And how dare you make me do this? And I really hate this. He's a barbarian. He sucks. And then by the end of the episode or the next episode, she like, and they're like, okay, give me your guns. Give me his guns. And you think she might do it? And then she like whips the gun out on the guy.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah.
You're love
loyal.
That.
Good woman.
Yeah, they have a good relationship too, and then all culminates in the end where they're both spreading ashes of her family, and then he's letting go of Mariko at the same time.
Let your hands be the last to hold her.
That's a good line.
Yeah,
I like that line a lot.
Which I didn't realize until I looked it up further, but people pointed out that was a callback to the first episode. When Mariko told her the same thing, let your hands be the last to hold them.
Oh, yeah.
About her family. Yeah.
Oh. Right. Yeah. I remember like joking about it with like friends at work. It's like, hey, if we ever interrupted our boss, do we have to commit seppuku to honor ourselves?
Yeah.
And then someone was like, if we did that, then we'd all be dead by now. Yeah. It's just an interesting like way of like, it's just an insight into what the culture was back then and probably a little bit now with, you know, less suicide.
Well, I think that's also I think they do still do some suicide stuff. Like, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, some, but not
I'm pretty sure, like, the operators of the Fukushima plant, I'm pretty sure they killed themselves from what I heard.
Yeah.
After that meltdown.
Yeah.
Like, so they do, it is still kind of a part of the culture there.
It's kind of a thing. It's like the traditionalist, yeah.
Yeah, but even just, like, one of my notes here is they kill babies for honor. Speaking of Fuji's babies specifically.
Fucking crazy.
But, and that's episode one, and that's part of the point is John comes into this culture where he's like what do you mean you kill babies to satisfy somebody getting offended over what you did? Like, you have to die, like your whole lineage has to die. What is this culture I'm stepping into? And especially because this show it is made for a Western audience in mind, and that's like you're seeing it through his eyes, and you're like, well, yeah, to our morals, this is horrifying. This is like, what are you doing? And then by the end of the show, he's more than willing to be Mariko's second when she's committing seppuku, because he knows how much that means to her. I nearly got emotional when the guy who was supposed to be her second didn't show up, and then he offers for her, and I'm like, oh man, this means so much to her. And like now you know what it means too. You've been trying to keep her alive more than anyone else on the show. And when it's finally her time to die, you step up and you'll make sure that happens, because you know that's in her mind, that's her duty, and duty's the most important thing to her. And you understand that death isn't just a throwaway. There's a reason. There's a greater symbolism behind it all.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I loved Blackthorne's character progression throughout this whole show, and how he's just like, how he hates everybody at the beginning, calls everybody savages, and then he slowly just like becomes more in tune with the culture and has more respect for it. It's funny because it's like, oh, are we going the white saber trope? We're not. It's just, here's a white guy in the middle of this, you know, Japan story, which is which I thought was pretty funny, but it was just well done as well. And I love seeing his character progression, because I think a lot of it is him starting to respect the culture, but I think it's just also his respect for Mariko as well. Yes. Because I think if it was any other character who was translating for him, he wouldn't have been as willing to sort of in tune to their ways. So that's my theory. But
I love the ending. Or I think it was episode 9 or maybe even 10, where he finally gets his crew back, and then he has that confrontation with his one crewman where he's like, oh, he's like, he's so rowdy and rude, and he's not like, he hasn't bathed, he smells bad. It's just like, I don't really like guys in my own culture anymore. And then he tells Yabushigi, like, well, I know I don't belong in Japan, but my own people seem foreign to me now too, so don't really know where I fit in anymore at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty interesting, because that was him in like the first couple episodes. And I love the line. I love the line he says, I think it's episode 2, where he's like, we set up a bath for you. He's like, but I bathed already. You want me to catch the flux? It's like bathing multiple times is just foreign to him, because he's just a, you know, just English sailor, and they don't do that much. But I thought that was pretty funny. Just like, again, the culture mixing or bashing was very well done. Just like the small moments on the show was well done.
Yeah.
Like when they're sneaking out the city, and Blackthorne provides a distraction for Toranaga, and he's like, this is how you treat women? And he starts just like rampaging through everything. And they're just like, who's this barbarian that's just rampaging through all our soldiers? This is ridiculous.
Yeah, I also like how the Portuguese were trying to manipulate people too, because they're like, oh no, this guy's just a barbarian pirate. Like, Portugal is the only civilized country in the world that you know of, and this guy's one of our enemies. He's just came here to kill us, that's all. Don't bother with him. He's got nothing of value to teach you.
Mm-hmm. And I like how the show very much doesn't tell you or doesn't side with either Blackthorne or the Portuguese in terms of like the church subplot. Like, they're both kind of in that gray moral area at the same time. They will both use their religion and you know, their beliefs to get what they want. And it's good storytelling. Yeah.
That's what I liked about the nuance of it too, because I feel like a lot of other shows would be like, oh, poor Japanese getting converted from their own religions. But this show demonstrates how they kind of take advantage right back. Because even the ones who, even like the leaders who got converted to Christianity, Blackthorne and a lot of other people are like, okay, but you're only doing this so you can get Portuguese resources. Like, maybe you actually believe in it, but you're doing it as a political ploy too. It's not just about faith, it's politics as well. And they don't really deny it. The Portuguese are doing it to get a spiritual foothold in Japan, sure, but the Japanese are accepting it to get trade opened up for their benefit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's well done. And again, it just goes to show the intelligence of the Japanese and doesn't dumb them down like other Western projects would probably do. And it's like, okay, we know you're taking advantage of us, but we're going to do the exact same thing. And it's I can't remember specifically what it was. Like, I'll allow you to have a church in my city, but and then I can't remember what he.
Then he puts the courtesans right next to them. For.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. The neighbors are the
courtesans. Well, if you give us a neighborhood, like it would be so great if you could give us a neighborhood. Oh well, I'd like a church, and then he puts them in the same spot.
Yeah. That was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Wonder who's going to visit there. Anyway.
I didn't realize this till I looked up further in the show, but Torunaga's domain, Edo, is the area that would later become Tokyo.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And that courtesan district was actually a very popular place for centuries.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. So it is a mix of so Shogun actually is pretty based in history. I heard Torunaga, Mariko, and Blackthorne are all based on real people. They have historical counterparts.
Yeah.
Which I don't know how faithful the book is to the actual historical people, but there is some parallels. It's not all fiction. The general time and place was real.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I remember, I think I remember seeing like a TikTok or a reel about that as well. Which is very interesting. I can't really find a fault in this show so far because
I've got a few, but they're not story based.
It's like a couple, like in terms of story, but I think it's just because it's just the way they tell is so different from like our Western view of things that just you're immediately like it's wrong, but it's just different. I don't know. Like, there's a few things I wish. I wish there was, like, a little bit more action. But for what we got, it was pretty damn good.
Yeah. If we're talking criticism, I've got issues with the cinematography. That irked me in a lot of spots. Especially in the first couple episodes, if you notice, there was... like, everything looked fisheye. Like, every damn shot was fisheye. Which...
Yeah, I thought a lot of the close-ups in the first episode were pretty fisheye.
Which I thought was just a stylistic choice at first, and then every shot was fisheye, which was annoying. And that got a little better as it went, but I could tell that... And I'm guessing that was just because the sets were narrow and they needed... Like, we had the same problem when we filmed a little further, and there was, like, an aerial shot of you on the ground, and we're like, well, we don't have the space to film with the lens we actually need to use, so we used a 16mm to widen the area, which fisheyed it, but it got us the shot we needed. So I feel like somebody was using the wrong lens or just trying to make up for the set being small and they needed more space. When they're like, we can handle a fisheye. Just based on our own experience in filming stuff and looking at the show, I'm like, well, I don't know what else it could have been, but a lot of fisheyeing in this show. So a lot of it was subtle, but it was still distracting for me once I noticed it. And the film grain was also really extreme for me. Once I noticed it. Yeah.
I noticed that quite a bit. But also I think that's like, it's just going to show like they're trying to show you like what the weather is like over there. It's very rainy, very depressing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't really notice the film grain as much. I don't think I noticed it really at all. But yeah, it was the fisheye lens. Like I slowly kind of remember some of the close-ups being pretty fisheye. And I think at one part, I could be mixing the two shows right now because I was watching them kind of at the same time, Fallout and Shogun. But there's one part where they went to handheld and it was so shaky. I was like, you need to stop this right now before I sue. Because anybody who watches the show knows that I hate fucking handheld shaky cam. It's the worst thing that's ever Hollywood has ever created. It's a bad trend. It's a gatekeep, like, such a lazy way to build up tension in a scene. Stop doing it. It's yeah. not good.
I can't remember the specific one in either show right now, but yeah, I believe that it was there. Yeah, so the cinema and just the general look of the show, like so many shots look beautiful and other ones I'm like, God, there's issues and I can't pinpoint what they are, but it just didn't click for me visually a lot of times. Even though what I'm seeing a lot of the time is great.
Yeah. A lot of the time I had to watch the show with the lights off because of how dark everything was. There was a lot of night shoots. And I was like, I can't watch this with overhead lighting right now.
Yeah, I had that problem as well, actually. I feel like half the show's set at night.
I think like five episodes worth is at night and five episodes worth is in the day. Just barely about. In the day because the weather is... I don't think there's sun at all in Japan, apparently. Like, what the hell's going on? It was just a bad couple months.
Yeah. Or maybe they're trying to... Like, I know the 1600s had that period where it was... I don't remember exactly what it was called, but it was a time where the Earth temperature cooled for a while. Like, the Earth's temperature used to be warmer, and then around the 1600s, things cooled off for a while. So they were just a generally colder period.
We could use that.
And then it started heating up again around the 1800s, and it's kind of just been on the rise ever since. But there was a dip there. And
that's crazy.
Which I guess it was around winter or spring, because everyone was wearing...
Heavier. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was winter.
Yeah, because everyone was wearing heavier outfits the whole time. Which, I saw a behind-the-scenes featurette, and the women in particular was like, oh yeah, these were heavy. We were wearing a lot of layers.
They look heavy.
Five layers. Thick. That's how I knew they were well-designed, because I'm like, oh, this doesn't just look like cheap costuming... thin fabric. It looks like actual functional clothing for a cold climate.
I would bet you, I haven't done any research about the costume design, but I bet maybe some parts of it made the costumes in like the way they would have made it back then. I don't know if that's confirmed or not, or they would have used some modern tools to kind of help with the design, but it just looks so authentic.
Well, in the featurette I saw, they did use Japanese materials, like Japanese silk, okay. I think they said in one. They did base some of the designs off actual historical artwork and whatnot they saw. They also tried to differentiate between working class people and richer people and people in the fishing village versus people in Osaka, or even the people in Osaka versus the lords in Osaka. Like, everyone, there were distinct fashions and color palettes for every area. Certain designs on the armors were also, and the armors and kimonos were also tailored to each character. Like, there was that one character, I think her name was Kiku. She was the one courtesan. She was like the only one in the show who wore vibrant red. So she always stood out.
Yeah. very interesting character, Kiku. Yeah, well, I kind of liked her subplot with the nephew of I'm gonna butcher this name, Yabushiki. It was very interesting subplot because like he's in love with her, but she's like one of the high courtesans, and she kind of uses like her sex for power, which is very interesting. It's a good storytelling. I've heard someone compare this to, there's a lot of Game of Thrones comparisons, and I heard someone say it's like Game of Thrones but focused on one family, which is not really true because there's a lot of families in this show, but it is very Game of Thrones-esque in terms of the storytelling.
I was losing track of who was related to whom at some point. Mm-hmm. By the end, there was the old man, I don't remember his name, and then when he committed seppuku and he called Buntaro up, I'm like, wait, Buntaro was his son? How did I not put that?
There's a lot of exposition in the first couple episodes where, like, oh, my son and my nephew, it's like, okay, this, hold on, I need a chart.
Yeah, and it also doesn't help that I don't speak the language and I'm trying to watch the show while reading the subtitles and, like, once again, this is me maybe just being a snob about it, but also you do miss things when you don't know the language. You're concentrating on, your brain's in a few different places at once. I'm trying to watch the show. I'm trying to read the subtitles. I'm also trying to comprehend the dialogue while taking in the visuals. Things slip through the cracks if you don't know what's being said.
Yeah, that is the tough part. I totally agree, because like I was trying to both read the subtitles and watch the actors act and trying to see if I could pick up the subtle cadence of what they were saying and see if I could pick up on subtext whatsoever. It was hard, but yeah, I always find it's tough to do that when you're watching a foreign film or international film, I should say.
But speaking of the actors, I thought they were all incredible in this show.
Yeah, everybody was phenomenal. I don't think there's one actor who I thought was bad.
I think the best was Anna Sawai as Miracle.
Yeah, she's a standout. She's phenomenal.
Just every scene, she was amazing. I'm also a really big fan, like I said, of... I'm sorry I'm mispronouncing all these names probably, but Moika Hoshi as Fuji. Mm-hmm. I think Fuji stood out too for what little screen time she had. I loved her. Like, not as much in the beginning. I just kind of pitied her. But when she became John's consort and a different side of her opened up, she became one of my favorite characters consistently.
Yeah, she's pretty good.
Yeah. Hiroyuki Sanada as Torinaga, obviously. It's great. Cosmo Jarvis is Blackthorn. Everybody's great.
I did like Torinaga's son, who Yoshi Nakakato. Oh my god, I'm so sorry, everybody. Yeah. we apologize to the country of Japan for these butchering of these names. But yeah, I liked how his and it's one of those lines that Torinaga's lines too is like, why is everybody who seeks wars never fought in one? Which I think is a good line, and I liked his sort of like drive to, you know, protect his father, but also start his own legacy. And when he's about to kill his uncle, and that's a shocking moment, he like slips on the rock and busts his head open. I was like, holy fuck, I did not see that coming. I was like, oh, this is when the war starts, right? And then there's just another subversion of the of storytelling that's just kind of like, oh fuck, plant your feet, kid.
Yeah, and then his uncle throws it back in his face after that, and he's like, what, this was the big death you wanted? Really?
Yeah, that was pretty wild. Yeah. I think the uncle was an interesting character, just even though he comes in kinda late for the show, he played like being the snob brother that took his place on the council pretty well. And you could feel the major threat that he was.
And I thought, well, when I looked on the Reddit forums every week after this show, and I saw a lot of people theorizing that he was a part of Toranaga's plan, that his betrayal was just for show, and that he'd turn around at the last minute and be, ha, this was a trick. And then he didn't. And it was just a betrayal. Mind you, it was maybe also part of Torunaga's plan still, but... Which I was nearly convinced, just like John, that Torunaga actually had given up. Because he was, like, coughing and weak that entire episode, and his son had just died, and his city was surrounded by his enemies, and he was talking about surrender and seemed to have no plan. And then I'm like, oh, no, there's a trick. And then it just kept going and going and going. And then he makes his top aide commit seppuku in front of everybody, and he's crying about it, like, well, I want to stay firm. But and then you find out later that the whole thing was planned. It was just for show.
Yeah.
He planned that guy to die. He planned Mariko to die. At the end, he tortures the fishing village just to make John prove his loyalty and stay. He's willing to use pawns crazy. In his game.
Yeah, and that's what I love about his character, is just how, like, miles ahead intellectually he is than everybody else. And I kind of agree. Like, I thought he was giving up at first, and I was like, no, there's no way. Like, there's just no way he's giving up this easy.
They were getting me convinced. Like, no way. And then there was a certain point where I'm like, I think he actually might have given up.
I think a part of him wanted to give up. I think that's what it was too. But then also, he's like, okay, in order for this to work, and it just fits the whole theme of their culture, right? Where it's like, we live and we die, and they use death as just sort of a just strategy, especially with his best friend who has fought with him to in like multiple battles and throughout his whole life. And he's like, I'm gonna need you to kill yourself in front of all these people to in order for this plan to work.
Yeah. It's yeah, once again, as a Westerner, it's hard to fathom, but really interesting to see play out.
Yeah. It's just awesome to see, like, a true mastermind genius at work. Even though, like, you don't fully agree with his tactics, you're like, huh, that's pretty crazy.
I like that one line in episode 10 at the end when Yabushigi's calling him a chess master, and he says, I don't control the wind, I only study it.
Yeah, that was a good line too.
So I'm like, oh, yeah, that's him just saying, I don't actually manipulate things, I just kind of see where the wind's blowing, and like nobody else, I guess, notices. He just knows how to go with the flow in the proper way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a lot of beautiful poems or haikus that they say throughout the show that, like, are really touch. And it's funny because, like, when you read the translations, you're like, that doesn't make sense. but the way they say it, it makes sense in, like, their cultures. And I think it's just maybe a bad translation, or it sounds weird when it's translated over to English. But, I just keep repeating myself. It just adds to the world building of the of the show, and like the one the very last one where Torunaga's wife, I think it's his wife again. I need a chart. It's like, those words are too beautiful to come from me. It was like, oh, they come from Lady Mariko. And it's just he's about to like break down. It's a really nice touching world building mechanic that they use.
I like how that whole last episode was just about Mariko's legacy. Basically, everyone's just breaking down thinking about her, and you can feel her absence in that whole last episode. What a ballsy move, killing off your third main character, like, out of your main trio from the second to last episode.
Yeah.
Like, it's how's episode 10 going to go? Yeah.
Yeah. He killed off the best character. I wish there was a big battle, though. I do wish there was, like, a big battle. Just because of, like, how well their action was.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, okay, I understand why there may not have been, though, because I saw the VFX, one of the VFX heads, he was talking about how he said something like a typical show with visual effects has 1,000 to 2,000 VFX shots in a show, and Shogun has 5,000 to 6,000. So they were already...
Yikes.
Yeah. They were already pretty stretched in terms of effect shots.
Okay, fair.
And mind you, for 5,000 to 6,000 effect shots, I barely noticed.
Yeah, it was barely. Very well done. The only times I did notice were like the, I don't even know what you call them. I guess like the establishing shots of towns. Where yeah. You could be like, oh yeah, that's obviously CG. But like, other than that, you can't really tell most of it.
Yeah, like I was seeing some footage of the blue screen on it, and it's just like, oh, even some of the, like all the buildings down the streets are CGI too. Like they didn't build that much really. It's pretty crazy what they got away with on that show. Or even like in the scenes with all the extras, they're like, oh yeah, maybe there's 100 to 200 people here and then the rest are digital. And I never batted an eye twice thinking about that. That all just looked real.
Huh. Yeah. I didn't really think about that.
Yeah. A lot of those crowd shots are just, yeah.
It kind of reminds me of like in some episodes in Invincible, there's like, there's a shot where it's Debbie and Omni-Man eating like, or having like coffee at a cafe in the background. It's just it's not hand-drawn, it's CGI people, and they're just like moving like this. But you're not paying attention to them. It's just funny where you're, what happens when you look around. But yeah.
Yeah. I'm just looking down up and down my notes now, and I just found this one line that's when he's talking about why he kept Blackthorn around. Not because he's important. My banner would survive without him, but because he makes me laugh.
That's why we keep it. Justin around. I'm kidding, Justin.
He's got a lot of practical knowledge about stuff.
He's going to message me in a week and be like, hey.
Yeah.
That's not nice. I'm just kidding, Justin.
That. Yeah, I just like
that's why we keep Tor around. Sorry.
I like that's Torunaga's only reason for not having John killed. Or just discarded earlier. Like, I just keep you around because you make me laugh. That's it. That's You're not funny. Actually that useful. Which is hilarious in the context of the show because he didn't actually do that much in the back half.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think that exchange between Torunaga and Blackthorn, not him asking him to kill him, but the when they're staring at each other and he kind of like nods at him, do you think that's... And my theory is that that's him... acknowledging knowing that he had something to do with his ship burning. He's just kind of like, huh.
Yeah.
And they like laughs it off a little bit. That's what I think happened.
I think so too, but I also think he didn't care because...
Oh yeah. He's just like, I see what you did.
Yeah, because as the theories are going right now, the stuff with him as an old man didn't actually happen. That was just him imagining how awful his life would have been if he'd held on to Mariko and gone back home. He would have just had all these trinkets from Japan and die an old man sad with regret. And his grandchildren are like, oh, did the savage really give you that sword? Like everything he did, everything he learned, he'd go home to people who just don't get it. And that's the worst future he could imagine for himself. So... Mm-hmm. Being stuck in Japan in the end was like, well, I guess there's worse things to do.
Yeah, at first I did think it was like a flash forward. And then there's that moment where it like cuts to him in the future and then it cuts to him in like the present and he's looking back, kind of like he's looking at that future. Mm-hmm. So I at first I was like really confused at the flash forwards. I was like, oh no, it's his imagination of a... of his future, just being bedsick. And that makes sense too, why he has the necklace in the bed and not in the present. But
he let it go.
He throws in the river. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I like their final, like, actual speaking conversation with each other, like, just kill me. And he's just like, no. I still refuse.
Yes. He actually,
because it's like, he doesn't really want to see him dead. Yeah, like, physically stops him.
He was just pushing him to see if how far he would go.
Mm-hmm. See if he would actually do
it. I am your enemy. I've been lying to you since I got here. I'm not a good person. Let me die.
Let me die. No. You're funny. I like having you around.
I like how petty Torunaga is that way. Especially with that extra context.
Yeah. It's pretty funny.
Oh, and of course, we haven't even talked about the big twist at the end of all that, where Yabushigi finds out that his secret heart is that he did want to be shogun the entire time.
Right, yeah.
Even though the entire show, he's like, no, I don't want it. I don't want it. I don't want to be shogun. I want peace. Shogun's a selfish thing. I don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's his secret heart just for himself. That's what he wanted the whole time.
Mm-hmm. And he's going to slowly build up an army to become a shogun.
Yep.
Roll credits.
Well, that's what I liked, is Torunaga looking out at the horizon and then it said shogun over top of him. I'm like, yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. He wins.
Yeah. It'd be very interesting to see, like, I know this is where the book ends, this is where the story ends, but the show is so gosh dang popular that will the, like, producers force them to make a second one, but also the showrunners don't, it's going to be interesting to see if this does get greenlit for, like, a second season or not. I don't think it needs to, but I wouldn't be upset if it did. I don't know.
I really hope it doesn't. Just because it's... Once again, adapt other books. Adapt other stories in this time period. That's fine. This particular world doesn't need to go on. I'm fine leaving it here. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
It doesn't need more. That's the problem. And that's the difference between a regular TV show and a miniseries. TV shows are meant to have longevity. A season can end on a satisfying note, but it needs more to keep it going. Like, okay, we just talked about Fallout on our last episode, and just for example, one thing we forgot to mention on that episode is we don't really know a lot about Muldaber. We never really find out what her whole deal was or how she came to be where she was. That's a loose thread. Or a lot with the ghoul, too. We don't find out. Like, yeah, everyone's story's wrapped up to end up season one, but there's still more. A miniseries or a limited series, by design, this is it. They didn't think any further ahead than this because that wasn't what it was supposed to be. And that's why things that were miniseries or limited series that get season two always suck. I don't think I've ever seen one or heard of one that was actually successful, that kept going, that was very famously designed to just be for one season and was obviously just supposed to be a one and done thing. And then they keep going. It always is bad. So,
but big Japan battle. No, I agree. I think, if they can't, I think what it all comes down to is story. If there's not like a good story reason or enough build up story wise to keep going, then they shouldn't do it. I do think they did end on a pretty satisfying note, in terms of like Torunaga won, but he won in a way you didn't expect. And I think that's the brilliance of the show, is it just defined your expectations the entire time.
He didn't need a massive suicidal battle just to prove he could have victory on the battlefield. He already won, and most people didn't even realize it at the time. That's one of the greatest twists I've seen on TV in a very long time that the main character won and most of the audience in the second to last episode and most of the audience doesn't even realize that that was the climax. Even though Mariko's last stand against all the guys blocking her exit, that giant battle with the ninjas coming into the Osaka castle at night and trying to assassinate them and guns are going off and samurai fights are going on. Like that was the big climactic action sequence you all wanted from episode 10. They did it early and just tricked you into thinking it would get bigger, but that was it.
Yeah.
And that was all it totally. Needed.
That is a good Game of Thrones comparison too, where like the 9th episode is usually the big climax. And then the 10th one is sort of the like follow up. Mm-hmm. That's very Game of Thrones.
Well, yeah, because why not explore the consequences? It feels weird to end.
Yes.
Just after the climax. Let's get a little time to mull over what actually happened here. Oh, yeah. Speaking of that, that also reminds me of the sad, but also it's kind of a darkly comedic bit about the ending when John is pulling his ship back up and then he finally gets it. And then he looks at Toranaga and all I was thinking was, didn't Toranaga just say he'll fix it and then I'll sink it again?
Yeah. Just to fuck with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. He's like, I'll let him build it and I'll probably sink it again.
Yeah. And then I'll probably just to tell see
where
him.
His loyalties lie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see.
Pretty good. Pretty good show.
Oh, just here's a funny note about a dialogue note. So there was one bit when Yabushigi's trying to fight John, and then John is like, this appears to be occurring. I just thought it was a funny.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Old, like, this is an old timey way of saying, well, this is happening. just doing that joke. And that one made me laugh.
That's pretty funny.
This appears to be occurring.
Yeah. John has some pretty good lines in this. He's a great comedic standout for this.
His insults are S-tier. It's
a lot of that British sarcasm that I'm fond of.
He's just very dry and vulgar and in your face.
It's like when he goes back to Isu, like, and he sees that guy's like, go fuck yourself, you snide, shiveling shit rag, and bows to the guy, but he doesn't understand him. It's so funny.
Actually, that was one of my favorite parts of the show, was John hurling insults to people, and then Mariko doing her most diplomatic translations of them.
Yeah.
That was consistently entertaining to be like, okay, how's she going to spin this one?
He's like, tell this fucking cocksucker.
He says he respectfully declines.
Or sometimes like he is displeased with your answer.
Yeah. Yeah, this show shows how important translators are.
Yeah.
To keeping good communication sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good show. Good show. I love
that. Yeah, it's the production value is insane. It the sets they built, the costumes, the makeup, just special effects work. It's all great. Acting's fantastic, writing's fantastic. It's just a very morally complex show with a lot of deep themes about life and death. And I like the metaphor of the, you know, the eightfold fence and everyone's got the three hearts. There's what was it? It's one for the world to see, one for your friends, one for yourself. Everyone's got their secret hearts that get slowly revealed. It's John fighting against the tide, fighting against destiny. It's like Toranaga said, you know, I don't control the wind. I just see which way it's blowing pretty much. And John is always against the wind. He's always just kind of floundering, doesn't accept his place where he is. It's about going to another culture, even close-minded, and letting them change you and seeing, oh, well, maybe where I'm from isn't all there is. Other people have good ideas to live to. And even if I don't understand it, it doesn't mean it's bad. It just means keep an open mind and learn more. Learn why it's the way it is. And maybe you'll grow as a person in the process. It's also just really cool to see all the political scheming. One of my favorite things about the show's writing is just all the politics is based on a thin decorum of respect. It's nobody's willing to go to open war. It's like, okay, well, we're not just going to have Toranaga assassinated and killed. It's okay, we have to like find a way to kick him off the council, and we can't vote to have him killed until we get a replacement for him on the council. Or even like Mariko's sacrifice is just to show in the open that their people are prisoners, but they knew that already, but they can't act on it because it wasn't obvious socially. Like the entire show is about based around all these subtle politics. Like you can't say what's actually going on. You have to prove it publicly to embarrass people or outsmart them. It's very underhanded, but fascinating to see play out. It's just all the societal rules that make the warfare engaging.
I totally agree. I love all the morality and the societal rules that go on with the show, especially with the council stuff. Because I think with any other probably like even in England or Western society, they would still scheme their way to like get Toranaga killed. And Ishido does do that at some point, but he does like most of the time, like their culture is so highly concerned with respect and legacy
and optics.
Optics as well. It just controls their entire lives and their decisions. And it's pretty fascinating to see. And I'm very happy to have watched the show just because, especially later on in my life, it's nice seeing different cultures and being exposed to them and seeing just their different viewpoints from time to time. I think it's really fascinating stuff.
Yeah. That partially gets me on to my question of the week here, which is this recent and intense desire for authenticity in works of culture more quelling of ignorance or limiting to creativity?
Sorry, I used a lot of big words there, so I have to think for a second.
To reiterate, is trying so hard to be authentic making people less ignorant, or is it just stifling creativity? Like, well, if I do something set in feudal Japan, now I'm going to feel obligated to make it as historically accurate as possible, where that might stifle some creativity but I'll get blasted for being inauthentic. Or is authenticity more important just because people are less ignorant if it's actually done properly? Like, is one outweighing the other
just,
now?
I think it's just more of the changing of the times. Like we saw with the change in Parasite, and that the authenticity is sort of now being more embraced. And I hear what you're saying. It is sort of...
But is authenticity the be-all and end-all is what I'm saying. Is it... Like, it is a good thing. I'm not saying it's not. But is authenticity better than just free roam? Free reign to do whatever?
I mean... I mean, put it like that, it doesn't sound good, but I feel like if you're trying to adapt something from, like, say you're trying to adapt a story from, like, feudal Japan, but you're not willing to do any of the research or even try to do some of the translation or even just do it, like, full, everybody speaks in English. Like, even if, it, like, the only way I could see it being accepted if it's in full English, if it's just because we're, like, it's a Westerner who actually cares about the story, but, like, if it was a movie, probably knows it won't be received that. It's just weird because I think it's just a changing of the times where people are now being more accepting of watching these international films, being more authentic, and being recognized more, especially in the Oscars.
I don't think it's
damning on, like, if you're going to, why are you trying to adapt a story if you're not going to be creative about it? You know what I mean?
Okay, so here's just an example off the top of my head about this specific show. James Clavell is, well, just according to this brief search I did of him, he's an Australian. Yeah, he was born in Australia. So he's an Australian guy writing about Japan, and I'm pretty sure this book came out in the mid-70s. And I haven't done much research into Shogun. I don't know if that book is very extremely historically accurate. I know this show went out of its way to hire a lot of consultants. Like, I saw they even had gesture consultants for all the actors, like everything from the actors opening the screen doors for people was tailored to be the gestures of the time period. Like, they really went above and beyond for authenticity in the show. But I don't even know if the original work it's based on had that level of authenticity. But also, this show probably wouldn't be getting made without that original work, which may be less authentic nowadays. So it's one of those things where if we're judging by modern authenticity, that original work may not have even been made, if that's the standard we're going to.
Well, yeah, I think, like, people can be smart enough to recognize the turning of it ever being authentic now, but still respecting, like, times, like, of, you know, like, of the past, of, like, Hollywood not being as authentic as possible, because there's still some great, you know, movies out there that aren't, like, fully translated or fully in a foreign language. But I don't think it should limit your creativity to try to be as authentic as possible. Like, it just seems like kind of like a, it's kind of seems like you're trying to come up with a way to blame yourself for not being, not, I'm not saying you personally.
Yeah, just
as for it, being, yeah, like, creatively inept. So it's an interesting question that you pose, but I just feel like if you're not going to try to, like, say someone wanted to adapt, like, someone wanted to do a mini series on The Odyssey, but cut out all of the dialogue and cut out all of the, they don't even have to speak in, like, ancient Greece, because that's fucking impossible, but just, like, cut out the language of the book and just went full on Western, like, joking and sort of, like, modern, I guess, Marvel joking stuff, that the lack of authenticity of that is going to divert people away in terms of it being, like, critically well received. But if someone who is, like, really into The Odyssey tries to make it as authentic as possible, it's going to grant more praise towards it. I think that just comes with it. As authentic you are to the source material, you're just going to get more praise.
Okay, well, here's a counterpoint.
Because you're adapting it one for one.
I got a counterpoint for you from a less... let's take something like science fiction. Right, there's a lot of arguments about hard science fiction versus soft science fiction. And I do think it you can still argue it falls under the realm of authenticity, because I've had people, I've heard somebody say this to me before about Star Trek, where they're like, actually, I get immersion broken when I see them walking around the starships because artificial gravity doesn't exist. And stuff like that, like artificial gravity is inauthentic.
Well, then you're just talking to a stupid person.
I know. But I'm just saying, like, artificial gravity doesn't exist, but you take it out of something like sci-fi and it's like, okay, fine. If we're making a hard sci-fi book, yeah, sure. It shouldn't be in there because we don't know how to do that and you don't have a basis for it. But should works of cultural authenticity be treated the same way? There's like books more hard, like hard cultural, like hard sci-fi versus soft sci-fi. There's books that are like, okay, this one is obviously in its marketing and its approach, it's going for more a hard approach to accurate culture versus one that's more upfront about, yeah, I'm playing fast and loose with it. But just going in, you know that, and it's okay, just like as a genre thing, like sci-fi does. Is that an option?
Yeah, but like sci-fi is not, a lot of it's not based in reality. Like I can't levitate this mug in front of me with well, but that's the force what I'm saying, because that's not real. Yeah. It's not, that's, authenticity does not mean reality in terms of like adapting a, like a sci-fi story. It's not really the same thing.
I think you could make an argument. That's what I'm trying to argue.
I think
is,
you can make the argument day, because you're a devil's yeah. advocate.
A story, to me, a story at its core is about the human emotions behind it. Do I relate to the characters? Do I relate to the story being told? Does it emotionally impact me? The setting is kind of just window dressing on that. And if you're basing it in a real place, people are going to be more critical of it, but I don't necessarily believe it has to be one for one. Now, mind you, this is me just playing devil advocate. I do agree with you that if you're going to set something in a real place, you ought to make an effort to make that place as realistic as you can manage. But I don't know if you should be obligated to. As long as you're up
should
front
about...
Should
you not about, be all obligated to write something smart and grounded in reality?
But that's what I'm saying, though.
Or just
something
crazy off the deep end. Like, so you want to be known for writing something shitty?
Yeah, but the funny thing is, sometimes people don't even know what's up, right? Like, I remember somebody telling me they were writing a novel once, and it was set in medieval times, and they're like, oh, wow, in medieval times, they have indoor plumbing. They did have that, but it was like they kind of were looking into it, and they're like, oh, no, people, like your publishers will tell you you can't include stuff like that because generally held opinion is they didn't. So even if it's true, people still are like, oh, it's immersion breaking because I don't think that's true, even though it is. So some people, so even when you put actual facts in the book, if commonly held consensus is, I don't believe that's really true, people still have their immersion broken. So sometimes you can't win either way. If it's true, people don't even believe it. And if you don't, and if it's not true, people get mad at it for being inauthentic. So sometimes you can't win either way. So sometimes I'm like, well, just do what you want then.
I don't know. I think you're grasping at straws here, if I'm being honest with you. Maybe. I think you're trying to create a problem where there is none. Like, yeah, I understand, just, like, the indoor plumbing
thing. I'm just arguing
thing,
it out.
But it's like, okay, but if there was indoor plumbing, and, like, there kind of was, but there wasn't at the same time. It's not this, like, same indoor plumbing as we have now. But it's like, yeah, like, I get it, but if it's like, and then if people do their research and like, oh, this is an actual thing, like, oh, I guess they're being authentic. So, okay, cool. And I know a lot of people don't do their research, and there's a lot of keyboard warriors out there who just like to scream on Twitter. But it's just like, if you can tell when effort is being put into a show or a project, I should say. And when you feel, it's just, it's kind of subjective at the same time. It's like when you feel that authenticity, it just immerses you more into the project. Like, I think, I'm trying to think of like a sci-fi example that's just way too fucking wacky that like broke my immersion, but I just can't right now. Because a lot of it's kind of like, oh, probably like, this is a really weird one. But like one of the first episodes of The Magic School Bus, the guy takes, one of the kids takes his helmet off in space and it becomes like an ice sculpture. And then later on, he's able to be revived somehow. It's just like, okay, that's weird. But also you're a kid. So maybe a kid show wasn't a good example to bring up. But it's just, yeah, it's all about intent, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Like, what is your intention with what you're trying to tell here? With Shogun, their intention was to tell the story as authentic as possible. And I think with some of these projects, I keep bashing them every week, but with Halo, I think their intent is just to tell a fucking crazy sci-fi story, even though they don't really care about the world that they bought the rights for.
Can somebody keep a counter of how many times Ryan's bashed Halo in a row for these episodes?
I think I'm on at least six. Like you're six on a or long, seven in a row.
I think you're on at least four in a row. Maybe
until
even more.
They cancel the show or they redo the like Neil Blomkamp movie that was supposed to come out like 10 years ago that looked really good. I will not stop bashing this show as a true fan of the franchise.
Yeah. Well, okay. I am grasping at straws a little bit just to play devil's advocate, but my actual belief on it is if I'm consuming something and it's wrong and it's inauthentic, I don't actually care that much as long as the story is well written. The details and world building aren't as big a deal to me. World building is very important to some people. For me, I'm more focused on characters and story. I don't really care personally, but I do appreciate when effort is put in. I think Shogun is great when I can say, oh, I really enjoyed that. Oh, and having looked more into it, it's actually pretty accurate. That's impressive. I respect that. It probably wouldn't impact my enjoyment because I don't know what's authentic either way. But having looked into it more, it makes me respect it more. But if it was completely inauthentic and it was still decently written, I wouldn't care. And that's the honest truth.
All right, that's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. Like, I honestly don't look for, if it's like a project that I'm not used to or I don't really have much of a background on, but the story still carries it well enough and the characters carry it well enough, then I think it's a good thing. I mean, a good example was Fallout, was the show, where I didn't really know much about the world or the implications of what happened in that world, but the characters really helped me enjoy the entire story and made me want to go back and play those games.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I kind of agree with you there.
Really, if anything, I think this argument of authenticity is just for snobby, educated people. It's the curse of education. The more you know, the more everyone else's ignorance becomes noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow.
It's kind of like that with filmmaking in general.
Yeah.
It's like, you're going to learn about how we make the magic and it's going to ruin it for you. But you can help make that magic for someone else. I heard a film teacher say that once.
Yeah. It's just, it doesn't bug me. And that's what I'm saying. It doesn't bug me now. But if I were to do a deep dive on feudal Japan and then started watching more stuff set in this era, I'd probably start getting more pissed off. But because I'm ignorance is bliss. I don't know. I don't care.
Well, now that you mention it, like one of my like favorite underrated movies is Troy. And that movie is ripe with inaccuracies after like taking a Greek myth course and reading the Iliad afterwards. But I had watched the movie before I knew anything about like the actual quote unquote real life story, even though it's technically all myth. But it's an adaptation, and you know, they did the creators did what they wanted to do, and I still think it's a decent project. I know my teacher hates it, but...
That's also a funny kind of situation. Imagine getting mad that you messed up an adaptation of a myth. You fictionalized fiction.
Yeah.
Or fiction. Well, you fictionalized something that was already fictionalized.
It's so strange because, like, Troy was an actual place. They just can't find it.
Yeah. But that's why I corrected myself there. I'm like, you're fictionalizing something that you're fictionalizing history that was already fictionalized in the version you're adapting.
Yeah.
So you're just going one step further. It's odd. It's broken telephone. That's all that is.
Yeah. It's pretty wild.
And you enjoy it. So that's valid.
Oh, so it's Brad Pitt and, I almost said Idris Elba, but it's not Idris Elba. Oh my God, Eric Bana. The two squabbling out. Those two fantastic actors. And Orlando Bloom. There's a lot of actors in that movie. Everyone should give it a watch. Yeah. Ben Cross. Not Ben Cross. The fuck's his name? The guy from X2. Oh my God. Whatever. We'll figure it out.
All right. Alrighty. Where can we find you?
Well, you can find me at Ryan Walker Official on YouTube, TikTok, and on Instagram.
You can find me on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook at ThoughtPlane Media. Also, check out the Close Up with Ryan and Joe Facebook page for latest updates on the show. If you listen to us in audio, check out our YouTube channel. And if you're on YouTube, find us anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. We hope to see you on the next Close Up with Ryan and Joe. Till next time.
Marco-sama.